First, however, is concerned enough or bothered enough by this potential investigation that he's threatening, it sounds to me almost like when he was threatening to get rid of the filibuster, he's threatening to remove that kind of power status for the minority. The danger, I think, political danger for him is this idea of partisanship being thrown back in his face, because in fact three senators, by my count, Olympia Snowe, Chuck Hagel, and Mike DeWine, actually want to join with Democrats in having a public investigation.
Yeah, that's the way it looks to me, too, on the NSA spying issue. What Pat Roberts wanted to do,
Pat Roberts, being the chairman of the committee, wanted to take the
findings of the weapons of mass destruction investigation that they conducted and say, look, this raises big issues about intelligence as to Iran and North Korea, future threats that the country might face. Let's investigate whether we've got good intelligence about that. The Democrats wanted something completely different, as you say. They wanted to investigate the possibility that the administration lied about weapons of mass destruction, or that the Ahmed Chalabi was, you know, influential in
but there had been previous investigations of all that, had there not?
Well,
including work by the Intelligence Committee itself.
Yeah, yes, indeed. But the Democrats wanted to go back and investigate it with a political edge. There's no question about it. NSA spying is another thing. Now they want to do Dubai as well. The difference is, it is it's obviously politics.
Is the politics of deceit yourself. That's what all of this is all about. To keep people locked within the matrix. You talk about the raggedy Democrats playing politics. Well, the game of politics was played out by Boy George in his weapons of mass destruction scenario. Even though we know that the core of the weapons of mass destruction for the U.S. Empire is the imperial apparatus that they see on the horizon, i.e. the Euro, and its escalating power and influence. But see, that's not the game that you guys want to deal with, because that would help shield people away from the illusion that you're trying to spread with your benefactors and allies like Chalabi, like lies about previous investigations, and on and on and on. Well, let's investigate the world of corporate finance power and dollar imperialism. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check. Listening to 103.3, 101.1 in Santa Cruz with Skid, 107.5 North Carolina, 96.3 Antelope Valley, propagandapress.org, thezepreport.com, radioforall.net's your universe, and of course, Louver, and click into the slave web, just Google it. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to explore an aspect that deals with the forms of pillars of imperialism. Dollarism. The greenback. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3. Slave Revolt.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe. Believe.
U.S. dollar system is one of the pillars of the U.S. global imperial domination. And it is in serious decline. The capital imperial militarized institutional machine and its administrators that serve this ruling order, Democrats, Republicans, neocons, lobbyist interests, etc., are determined in maintaining the world in its dollars and chains matrix. We're about to explore this in this Ruins of Empire segment called Dollars and Chains, U.S. Imperialism in the Age of Petrodollar Decline. Tonight we're going to kick it off with William R. Clark, author of the book Petrodollar Warfare, and let him get it started as he describes the dilemma that the U.S. greenback, the dollar, is in versus its euro competitor. So check this out.
The United States is unfortunately engaged in economic warfare against the European Union because the euro currency is designed and was implemented to be an alternative world reserve currency. And that will be largely determined whether or not major oil producing or oil exporting countries use that currency. And if the dollar begins to lose its world reserve currency, just like the British pound did back in the 1920s, then these deficits that we have, they're not sustainable now, but they will become completely unsustainable in the future if people begin to buy less of our debt up because they don't need to hold as many dollars in their central bank accounts so that they're using euros to pay their monthly energy bill.
All right. Now, as he opens it up, talking about the economic warfare game that is really taking place between the EU25, now it's 25 nations included in the European Union, and the U.S. What this gets to is an aspect of a certain hegemony that has existed for years within the American experience and how that has played out. There's various phases, and one of the phases is more or less like the gold standard phase. This was after the imperial wars that were fought during World War II. And in the aftermath of the World War II, much of course, Europe, Japan were destroyed, their industrial base, that is. The U.S. was then in the Bretton Woods Monetary Conference that was established. A new monetary system was based off the U.S. dollar. 44 countries were represented at this Bretton Woods conference. And the conference also established institutions like the World Bank. And they set the gold standard based off of the U.S. dollar at $35 an ounce. So as the American dollar was chosen as the backbone, because remember, the U.S. empire did not suffer an industrial catastrophe like its European counterparts did. This system called the Bretton Woods Gold Exchange System was what the world's monetary system was based in as a result in the aftermath of World War II. Now, Sam then helped for its political reasons, you know, rebuild Europe, Japan, you know, through the Marshall Plan as a buttress against the whole Soviet and the Cold War thing that had been manufactured and stuff. And set up NATO. That's when NATO was set up in 1949, you know, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. But during the early 70s is when the first phase of this American dynamic experience century within this kind of monetary system was coming to an end. And this had to do in part with several factors. One was that Japan and Europe were back up in production, and they were selling goods back out into the market, and so their industrial base was rebuilt. So the monopoly on trade that the U.S. had experienced was starting to tighten up. Also, the escalating dynamic of the imperial intervention in Vietnam was greatly draining the U.S. System. And another aspect was that the peaking of the U.S. oil production in the U.S. had hit its peak, as had been predicted. Now, this, beforehand, the U.S. had been the Saudi Arabia of the world. During World War II, in that period, the U.S. was the largest producer and exporter of oil in the world. So when this dynamic hit the U.S., it found itself in various forms of a crunch. And in the late 60s, right before the 70s, you could already see the whole Bretton Woods gold exchange start to break down. It really became clear when Britain broke with it, when its sterling pound was devalued in 1967. What then started to take place were that people seeing the devaluation and escalating war take place in Vietnam and the dollar value drop, they decided that they wanted to exchange their dollars for gold. So you had like a British ambassador in 1971 who actually showed up with $3 billion that he wanted in fixed exchange in gold. Now, gold being at $35 an ounce, basically, he wanted 2,600 tons of gold. So the U.S., being in the economic dilemma that it was in, it couldn't afford to do it, basically, because of its debts and expenditures that it was ramping up as the imperialist nation and in being in imperial contest that it found itself in with other market forces that were now back online after World War II. So on August 11, 1971, the Nixon administration basically just abandoned the whole gold standard. And when they did that, it allowed for the deregulation and the privatization of the dollar. So, of course, you know, Citibank, Barclays, Chase Manhattan, all, you know, the typical type players, pushed their way in control of the U.S. dollar that was now floating. Now, inflation took hold, and there was incredible amounts of problems with this particular dynamic. But what happened over the upcoming years was now about to set the course for the next stage of the U.S. empire. And that is basically when the U.S., who had already had an incredible tight association with Saudi Arabia, who has been instrumental in maintaining the U.S. empire's status as the most powerful empire in the world, a number of nations, and especially in OPEC, were talking about creating a basket of currency. In other words, they were all about to become involved in pricing oil, petrol, in what was called a basket of currency. Other currencies throughout the world, the Japanese yen, the Canadian dollar, the U.S. dollar, etc., etc. Now, the U.S. administration, of course, did not want that. They wanted it just in the U.S. dollar. So what they basically did was they had secret meetings with their allies and their main ally, Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabian government, being the largest producer of oil, went along with this in a meeting with Secretary William Simmons in 1973-74 meetings. And once that happened, once Saudi Arabia decided to go along with the U.S. and just having petrol being priced in U.S. dollars, the rest of the OPEC nations followed suit. And then you had a situation where the U.S., because there was an economic crisis with the dollar, they manufactured artificially the increase of oil prices, which has been known, you know, as the 73-74 oil crunch. But it was an intentional manipulation by the imperialist structures in the U.S. To increase the price of oil, because now that the oil currency was only going to be sold in U.S. dollar, then there was an alignment. If oil currency went up, then the price and the strength of the dollar automatically goes up, which is exactly what happened. One saw a 400% increase in the U.S. Or in oil. So this is the pictures you see, you know, in the 70s with people in long lines and all of that type of stuff. And but this was manufactured intentionally by the U.S. imperialists and their Saudi government and allies to manipulate the structure. Now, all nations all over the world had to bend to this, because everyone had to buy petrol in U.S. dollars. So they had to go and get U.S. dollars one way or another. In other words, be subservient to the U.S. dollarism system in order to buy the essential energy system, petrol, to buy oil. So you can see how the dynamic of dollar imperialism then took place within this spectrum. So when the Saudi Arabian Monetary Authority then established basically a petrol dollar recycling system via New York and London banks, which then laid out a new foundation of incredible power, imperial power, for the major players in this energy field: Chevron, Gulf, Mobil, Texaco, British Petroleum, Royal Dutch Shell. Because the banks, the surplus money that the OPEC nations were now getting, especially Saudi Arabia, for this incredible increase in inflated oil prices, the Saudi Arabian government and other OPEC nations would then use that extra money to buy U.S. Treasury and bonds and put the money in New York banks and in London banks, because the British were in a collaboration, or the U.S. let them be in collaboration, and a benefactor of this network and system. So you have a situation where suddenly the world population is faced with enormous debt and a skyrocketing prices for oil, and they needed the U.S. dollar to go ahead and buy this product. Now, the reason why I'm going into this in detail is that you can't understand, let's say, third world debt without understanding this dynamic that happened in the early 70s. It has nothing to do with irresponsible African leaders, irresponsible Latin leaders, or anything like that. This was manufactured by the imperialists, because they knew that the world had to trade, had to make their oil trades in U.S. dollar. So they needed the U.S. dollar to buy oil. So by the U.S. manipulating the oil prices up with their allies, the Saudi government in particular, 400%, then they basically were able to crush industrial growth worldwide and set a whole new stage of dominance over the masses of the world population, because now world populations had to do anything to get their products sold into the U.S. because they needed dollars. They needed U.S. dollars to buy oil. So societies had to take incredible means to have as low as prices to be able to quote-unquote compete, to get their products bought in the U.S., to get U.S. dollars to turn around and buy, you know, oil and stuff. So here's the, so this is the imperial dynamic that was taking place and has continued on in this particular dynamic. And the devastating impact that it has had on a national and global scale. Now, next, here Clark talks about the debt and the global energy crisis that Sam has been involved in and has been, of course, perpetuating. Check it out.
The only way that I can really foresee us pulling ourselves out is basically getting real serious about peak oil and energy issues by really doing what you might call energy reconfiguration, meaning changing our entire energy infrastructure to be less dependent on fossil fuels. I think if we make a statement, if we have a leadership that is pursuing that in a policy program, that the world community would say, well, you know, the United States is really in debt, but we don't want them to fall on their face. And they're now trying to be, you know, a good partner in this global energy crisis that we're feeling, regarding peak oil. And therefore, if we were to enhance our infrastructure, sort of like we did during the 1930s during the Depression with all those public work projects, I think that the Chinese and Japanese and Taiwan and whatnot will continue to support some of our debt. So we have to begin paying down our deficit, and we have to begin being good players or good consumers on the international market. And I think the only way to keep these jobs domestically in the United States is to do massive, massive energy reconfiguration programs on a scale that we have not seen since World War II.
So one can see that by this whole petrodollar situation that has been set up by the U.S. imperial structure, where oil is sold in U.S. dollars, in U.S. greenbacks, one can see how the situation of incredible hegemonic power and influence has been able to be ascertained by the U.S. Rulers within this order. And one can also see how a situation where in 1971, back with you know, the whole gold standard and all of that was set at $35 an ounce, gold represented 50% of the international reserve assets. But after that was replaced by the whole foreign exchange currency, it now represents the whole foreign exchange currency now aspect represents 95% of the whole situation. And the U.S. dollar has become the major reserve currency for most nations. So this whole switch from a gold standard to this dollar standard now has put the U.S. an incredible influence that it has used for its imperial power. This is why the two main pillars of U.S. domination on a planetary scale is its militarism and its dollarism. And the militarism is tied to the dollarism because it's how it's able to finance incredible its incredible military machine. Another kind of a cynical dynamic is that the whole debt aspect is a situation where, see, these imperialists know that the dollar, the whole dollar system is a core part and source, the true source of global inflation. But at the same time, they know that the world is locked into a situation where it must cover the U.S. debt because of the whole economic order would be unstabilized if the dollar system were just to crash. So this is why you have China and Japan and all of these other nations snapping up so much of the U.S. debt. Every day they you know, buy into U.S. Treasury and all of those types of things, so it overwhelms their society. But since this is a dollar in chains world economic privatized order, this is how these guys are forced in to and have historically, you know, since this new phase of the American experience, have been forced into this whole situation. So you have this whole dynamic that just keeps playing itself out more and more insidiously. And it has created an extremely unstable situation on a planetary scale. Now, next, let's go into as Clark describes what happened to all of the how all the electronic goods, cars, hardwares, dishes, you know, things like that, and how, you know, Walmart and all these little, you know, Circuit City stores and all of that, how that plays into why are all these products foreign products, more or less. Check this out.
So those goods become very, very expensive. And all that plastic stuff we buy from China becomes very, very expensive. We'll have to learn, again, like we did in the 1940s and 50s, how to make things domestically. You can't buy an American-made microwave, even if you wanted to. I mean, you could search all day long for weeks and probably not find one because there aren't any. And we get it, you know, from China and whatnot, and because it's very, very cheap. But if the dollar becomes displaced, then the ability of the United States to import all these foreign goods, we really deteriorate. and all the infrastructure, the manufacturing infrastructure, has gone overseas. We're going to have to slowly rebuild that stuff. And we have to do energy at the same time. These are very, very large issues. But the fact of the matter is, we have to restore our manufacturing base. And we also have to keep people from pumping the dollar. And I think the best way right now is going to be politically and economically working on energy issues. Because I think, like I said, if the world saw the United States is trying to be a global leader in implementing alternative renewable energy technologies. We became signees to the Kyoto Protocol and all these other type of things that the world community wants us to do. I think they will allow us to pursue some of these goals and still continue buying some of our debt, at least for a while. So we really have to reverse course of what we've been doing for the last 30 years, and it's going to be very, very painful. I mean, there's no question about it.
Okay, now, see, here you have a situation where, since the world is primarily locked into this petrodollar system, you have a situation where they need dollars to buy the essential resource of petroleum. So you have societies locked into a structurally adjusted competition with one another to more or less crush their populations down to get them to produce goods as cheap as possible so that they will be more appreciable to the buy-in public in America. Now, the reason why these populations are locked into this and have all eyes primarily on the U.S. is because the U.S. dollar is king. And it's a situation where the U.S., all it has to do and does do is just print up more dollars. So it just prints up more dollars, and that dollar, since it's locked into the oil institution, viability has been able to be sustained based off of that. So the U.S. then intentionally goes into debt, knowing that other nations will have to more or less eat the U.S. debt, which is what has been happening for years, because they need to still buy the resources that the petrol societies produce and stuff. Now, with the development of the euro, that has now bought into, since January of 1999, another dynamic that is the first signs of the challenge on an imperial competition level of the dynamic that the U.S. empire has found itself in. So, with some of these aspects outlined, now let's get into the Iraq situation that Clark explains through the various aspects of the contracts that Saddam had, the sanctions, and the trading switch that Saddam was now able to do, because there was now another option besides the U.S. dollar. So let's check this out.
It seems that there was a long strategy going back to late 1990 to gain control over Iraq's oil fields. I think principally because beginning around 1997, the world community began to realize that the sanctions were soon to be lifted, and so Saddam was approached by the government, both say France and China and Russia, for oil exploration contracts, which he agreed to from 1997 to up until 2002. About two-thirds of Iraq's oil was committed with a production sharing agreements, or PSAs, with these various countries, 30 countries in fact. However, the United States was missing from that list, and so was Britain. But what I think the final nail in Saddam's coffin was when he switched to the euro for his oil transaction currency in November of 2000. And he did that. He came out in September in 2000 and said he was going to do this, even though the euro at the time was at its lowest point to the dollar, about 82 cents to the dollar. And so people were scratching their head saying, you know, he's going to lose $400 million a year in oil sales from a switch. But he made it nonetheless. And There's a whole history to petrodollar recycling that began back in the early 1970s that most people really don't understand. And in my book, I try to explain the importance of petrodollar recycling regarding the dollar, the level of our currency, and what it means, and the fear, I think, by the Federal Reserve and the Bush administration and other OPEC countries, such as Iran, would possibly even Russia would move to the euro as the standard for the whole transaction and the whole pricing. And the first thing the Bush administration did after toppling Saddam in May of 2003 was, in fact, reconvert Iraq's oil transactions from the euro back to the dollar, even though at that time the euro was worth about 17% more to the dollar. So basically, the Bush administration wiped out 17% of Iraq's savings account, which was the oil food program, and redenominated back in the dollar. So it had a very adverse impact on Iraq's ability to rebuild its infrastructure. So I think if you follow the money very carefully and understand how these things work, it becomes fairly clear.
Okay, so you can see some of the dynamics that are playing out in this dollar imperialism game. Here you have a situation where September 24th, 2000, Saddam basically stomped out of a meeting with his government officials and advisors and stuff, and they said that they would transition their oil exports transaction now in euro currency. So they were basically challenging the U.S. Empire's whole petrodollar system. That has been part of the foundation of their hegemonic imperial supremacy since the 70s when they went off the gold standard, as I meant, mentioned before, to basically what we can call the black gold standard, petrol. So now you have a situation where when he first did it, the U.S. dollar was not lagging behind the euro, so you could still get more or less more bang out of the buck going with the U.S. dollar than you could the euro. Remember, the euro only got started in January of 1999, but certain events started to take place in typical market capital U.S. Fashion, where you had a situation where the U.S. had the dot-com bubble burst, that whole, you know, sham and everything. And then the Enron scandals and WorldCom, you know, so all of these things were starting to devalue the U.S. currency, and plus its incredible trade deficit. The private and public debt that the U.S. Society is in has had a very depleting effect on people's confidence. The total U.S. debt, public and private, has doubled since 1995. It's now officially over $34 trillion. It was just, I shouldn't say just, but it was $16 trillion in 1995. And it was $7 trillion in 1985. So this debt that the U.S. is accumulating, that it is used to discipline other countries, basically, because the other countries would have to just more or less eat this debt because they needed the U.S. dollar. And if the dollar declines, it becomes harder for them to buy the oil because the oil and dollar are locked in together. But with the euro emerging, you had Saddam, who was the first. He just he cowboyed it out. And even though he was the U.S. dollar was still above the euro, Saddam called it something like the enemy's currency or something like that. You know, but he just made the move. And what followed was further shocks on the U.S. dollar because of just the way the American society basically just runs amok, and how the discussion of how the U.S. dollar the role it plays on a global scale and how debt is played on a global scale via the U.S. versus other nations, how that really doesn't come into discussion, and how other nations are trying to find ways of getting up from under this situation. So, one of the first things that Sam did was switch, when they stomped their cowboy boots into Iraq, they switched the euro trading currency that Iraq was engaged in, even though it had made incredible more profits since they had first went over to the euro in September of 2000. They switched it back to the U.S. dollar at great loss to the Iraqi people. So, in other words, because the euro had appreciated 17% above the U.S. dollars. So if you're talking millions or billions of dollars, that's an incredible hit. But see, this is not about rebuilding. This is not about restructuring. This is about U.S. imperialism trying to maintain its hegemonic imperial power. And the dollarism's dominance is essential to that. And in this particular stage of its decline, it is using its military force to buttress and maintain the U.S. Dollarism's dominant position. So this is not about competing and all of that type of stuff. And this also goes into the aspect that when these imperialists, you know, they play these Orwellian games, when they talk about globalization, they're talking about dollarization. That's what real globalization means. I mean, it's just that raw. And this is the dynamic that other countries have found themselves in and are trying to maneuver. Now, let me make it clear. I'm not saying that the euro is the answer, because all of these privatized market systems are part of a chain situation. I'm just trying to make it clear of the dynamic that is taking place on an imperial global scale and show the dynamics that are now starting to buttress themselves and set the stage for imperial warfare and conflict on a global level. And this is why, you know, when you see these Democrats and all of that type of stuff, this is all smoke and mirrors, because all of them are here to maintain the U.S. imperialist global domination for the order, and maintaining the dollar's dominance on a global scale is key to that. And keeping it as a petrodollar reserve currency, the petrodollar reserve currency. Now, within this context, one can see why the U.S. Empire is building 14 bases in Iraq. It's not just to quote-unquote protect oil, but it's to protect the U.S. oil dollar currency, or what I basically call dollar imperialism. So let's check this out.
The United States has been building 14 very large military bases. In fact, near the Baghdad airport, under construction, called Camp Victory North, when it's completed, will be the largest overseas military base in the world. It will be twice the size of currently the largest base, which is in Bonn-Steel, Kosovo. And this base, I believe, will hold around 14,000 people. And has the largest PX, it has the Domino's Pizza, it has a Burger King, it has all kinds of stuff. But yes, we are building these massive military bases at a cost of $4.5 billion. That's really more money than what was spent on the so-called reconstruction of Iraq. So the $18 billion that Congress allocated, most of that was spent under, you know, for security reasons, to enhance the security for private military contractors. But the biggest chunk, the only real reconstruction going on in Iraq, were military bases. And I don't think the American people really understand But the Iraqi people know about these military bases, and if you read the news, the foreign news, they're very upset that these massive military bases are being built all over Iraq to hold about 120,000 troops permanently.
So once again, it's clear that the whole dynamic of some of the aspects that are taking place. In November of 2000 is actually when the whole program got started with Saddam. He came out of the meeting in September, as mentioned before. It gets instituted in November of 2000. And Iraq opened up a euro-based bank account. This was with a leading French bank, BNP Paribas. And this went to the UN account because, you remember, Saddam was in this whole oil for food exchange program. Now, at the same time, Iraq's account held about $10 billion. And some of the dynamics that started to play themselves out within that whole situation was that this is how and why you had nations like, you had the U.S. Empire and Crime Bill Clinton previously never want to lift the sanctions, because Saddam, previous to making this announcement, you have a tug of war going on. And previous to 2000, when Crime Bill was still president, Saddam was basically setting up all of his contracts with nations outside of the U.S. So China, France, you know, on down the line, they were all getting contracts. And what became clear was that Iraq is basically estimated. It's estimated to have about 112 billion barrels of petrol. Now, that may or may not be the case. And also, the imperialists worldwide in this whole imperial war have helped damage the fields, because you can't have these wars damage the fields, not have them refurbished, and not expect some consequences. So there may be some collapsing in some of the fields where they'll never be able to get the oil from because they've been damaged. But beyond all of that, you have a situation, and also because of UN sanctions, when you start an oil field and all of a sudden you cannot pull it out properly because you don't have the right equipment because of sanctions or whatever, the fields become damaged, and at a certain point it can become irreversible. But nevertheless, you had a situation where Iraq basically was setting up contracts with various nations, except for the U.S. and the U.K., except for one little small firm in the U.K. It wasn't British Petroleum. So the U.S. and the U.K. knew that once the sanctions were lifted, they were going to be on the outs. And China, France, and other countries were all lined up with incredibly enticing contracts at their disposal. When the imperialists, U.S. imperialists, swept in, they broke those contracts. And Russia's Luke Oil and France's Total Finet Elf, who had signed those previous contracts, they were just kicked to the curb. So this was the dynamic, the imperial dynamic that were that have taken place since the U.S. Intervention and occupation into Iraq, and and one can see how you have an axis forming, the imperial axis that the U.S. is aligned with is basically on a hardcore economic level is the U.K., which shares in the trading of oil and stuff like that through its bank systems with the New York banks, and Saudi Arabia. Those are the key axis to its dollar imperialism network and setup, and are essential to this particular setup. So this is why, in part, Blair and company stomped off with Sam, because their economic imperial interests are tied. Now, the UK is kind of wavering, because as the euro becomes stronger and stronger, they're being swayed and wooed to come over and be part of the European Union. But of course, this has not happened yet. And the U.S. is serious about maintaining oil for its own imperial dominance. Now here, let's get into Clark as he states what he believes needs to be made in America to keep the economy afloat. So, well, let's just hear what he has to say. Dig this.
You have to make it affordable for the rest of the world, in my opinion, energy-related technologies. It doesn't, you know, it could be solar panels, it could be, we have the Toyota Prius, but why can't Ford and GM build a car that gets 60, 70 miles per gallon? They could if they had the proper incentives. So you have to begin making technologies that are energy-efficient that the rest of the world wants. We have the education, but we don't have the motivation to do this. And we're losing the infrastructure every year to overseas manufacturing plants. So we've got to really get serious about energy and making products. We don't need to be making microwaves for the Chinese. We need to be making ultra-high fuel efficiency cars and ultra-high efficiency appliances and ultra-high fuel efficiency trains or airplane engines that burn a lot less kerosene or jet fuel. So we need to look at these types of technologies to pursue, because that's what the world, when peak oil arrives, that's what the world is going to want. That's what consumers are going to need. And so whatever country is able to make this transition that keeps a manufacturing base but uses less energy per, you know, economic output, there'll be a strong economy. And the economies that waste the most energy, which unfortunately is the United States economy, will really be in a world of hurt.
All right, now, if this was a cooperative society and world where the dollar system, which is part of the privatized construct for economic control and super privilege for the order, if that were not the case, then societies could conceivably move into a more cooperative type setting. But see, this is not the case. This is the real world. And the imperialists in the U.S. Ruling circles are not so much concerned about having the U.S. be a cooperative player in the world global market. They want dominance. They want control. In the same way that they're not concerned about the whole ecological collapsing that we keep seeing and reading about every damn day, you know, in the Antarctic and other places. So even though that is the case, that's not their concern. Their particular concern is maintaining their economic and hegemonic imperial power at all cost. And it has played factors in them controlling and disciplining the world, and in how the petrodollar whole situation being priced in U.S. dollars and their alignment with Saudi Arabia has played a key component in how the Cold War has been fought. And the reason why I mentioned that was that there were surveys and studies done by the CIA concerning the Soviets. And they realized that the Soviets were heading towards their peak, oil, soon coming up, you know, in the 80s and stuff. And they calculated that they would need to start pumping up their oil production to finance their adventure in Afghanistan. And they talked about how a devaluation in oil pricing would have a devastating impact on the Soviets. And what ended up happening was the Saudis started to pump out oil at incredibly high volumes during this same period, and it knocked the price a barrel of a petroleum down, and this played into the economic collapse of the Soviets. Now, these cats know this type of stuff. As a matter of fact, Thomas Friedman, who wrote in A New Mission for America, he wrote this in 2004, quote, "In November 1985, oil was $30 a barrel," recalled the noted oil economist Philip Berger. "By July of 1986, oil had fallen to $10 a barrel, and it did not climb back to $20 until April 1989. Everyone thinks Ronald Reagan brought down the Soviets," says Berger. That is wrong. It was a collapse in their oil rents. It's no accident that the 1990s was a decade of falling oil prices and falling walls. So in other words, when the Saudis, a key ally of the U.S. empire, started to pump up the volume in the world's oil supply, it brought down the prices, and the Soviets, who were in an economic, you know, trying to maintain their arms race, engaged in Afghanistan, they couldn't get out, and also were reaching their peak oil, as the CIA's own documents had noted. They just economically imploded within. So and the Soviets, just like everyone else, especially during that time, because the euro wasn't in formation, they had to buy the petrol in U.S. currency. So, of course, whatever price, that price of collapsing in the oil rents was basically the decline of the Soviet empire. So this is how these things play out, and how they know these are key components. Oil, petrodollarism, and all of that are key components of their domination and influence. Now, next, let's check out, as we go into how Clark talks about the two pillars of the two pillars of U.S. global hegemonic power, and how they rest on militarism and dollarism, and the U.S. dollar as the world currency, yet not with the situation that is set in place, as it explodes, the U.S. debt explodes on other nations. How things are changing as now they have another option besides the U.S. dollars in chains market game. So let's check this out.
Right, at the end of the Cold War, the United States became the largest debtor nation in the world, and that's not sustainable. If something is not sustainable, it will end. And we are using the dollar inappropriately to build up our military and use the petrodollar recycling flows to do things like massive tax cuts, which we can't afford when we have to do energy reconfiguration. So we're really abusing our status. Now, in the original couple decades, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, after World War II, we were very noble in what we did. We helped rebuild Europe and helped rebuild Japan. And we didn't really abuse ourselves until we went off the gold standard in 1971 and then cut this deal with Saudi Arabia in 1973. And for the last 32 or 33 years, we've really sort of been abusing our currency as the world reserve currency and not really abiding by good economic fundamental rules of what we should be doing regarding manufacturing and budget deficits and trade deficits.
All right, there's various things I want to get into, you know, as far as the U.S. being noble and all of that type of stuff before it went off the gold standard. Even when it was on the gold standard, it was still involved in, well, during the gold standard, it was involved in the imperial intervention in Vietnam. It had been involved in destroying the liberation movement in the Congo, as Che Guevara himself experienced. And other, of course, imperial interventions worldwide. The U.S. is not about anything but maintaining its global hegemonic power within the ruling circles. But some of the things that he brought up, let's deal with from the aspect of the perception and how things are played out. Because, you know, I went into all of the incredible amounts of debt that the U.S. Is involved in. And, you know, most countries are forced to control their trade deficits and things like that, and their debts and or collapse. But the U.S. empire, as noted before, its number one import is the dollar. All it has to do is make it up, because the petrodollar alignment and arrangement puts it in a position that no other country in the world is in, because it's based in the reserve as the reserve currency. So the various central banks in South Korea, Japan, China, wherever, all buy U.S. Treasury and securities with their dollars. And this is how the U.S. has been, the U.S. dollar has been quote unquote stable. Now, there's no real true stability in this whole economic game that they're playing, but, you know, relatively stable, even though, and has been able to maintain, you know, much lower interest rates and stuff like that. But the U.S., you know, when you hear people talk about other countries, especially third world countries, being debtor nations and stuff like that, here, the U.S. is the greatest debtor nation in the world. But since it's involved in a petrodollar currency situation, it is able to push off its debt on other countries that have to get the U.S. dollar to buy a petrol and stuff. So so if you compare it to other countries, when, say, the Congo or some third world country, when it goes into debt, then the U.S. and the U.K. get their IMF, World Bank, so on and so forth, and they put in these various draconian structural adjustment programs and austerity measures, which crush and discipline the particular societies and make them pay back as much as possible their debt at the expense of hospitals, schools, etc., etc. So this is why you have this continuous perpetuation of poverty, malnourishment, and deterioration of the infrastructure. In other words, the U.S. debt and its petrodollar system is underdeveloping by its very design the third world and stagnating the development of the rest of the world in general. But it perpetuates hegemonic power within the particular order. Now, how the U.S. then disciplines its internal population is that it slashes and makes all these taxes and to further increase its debt and stuff internally and externally, knowing that someone else has to buy it off. So it would look too obvious if they were to have the IMF come into some inner city and then, you know, put in austerity measures, on some black folks and stuff. So they just play a slight manipulation within that game and attack public school systems as not being efficient and the whole and say that big government as it's designed within this whole corporate market system doesn't work efficiently, even though they use the corporate government situation as a vehicle of destruction and control. But they use that as a way of making cutbacks internally on the disposable people. So closing of hospitals in the inner cities, the privatizations of schools, the incredible cutbacks on basic facilities and outlets and stuff like that happen internally, and a part of the crumbling infrastructure that takes place is that they export these jobs out to these other countries because the rulers power in the dollar, which is part of their imperial mechanism, is not just rooted in American productivity. In actuality, it's rooted in the petrodollar system and the fact that other countries have to discipline their population to sell products into America to get dollars. That all the U.S. rulers have to do is just print up in their little Federal Reserves. So one can see the dynamic of the whole disciplining aspect that is taking place and why militarism is so essential. Now, Brzezinski, who was the senior advisor, former senior advisor during the Carter administration, he's written a classic book that I've mentioned before called The Grand Chessboard. And this gets into the aspects of how things are developing and how he himself saw things developing in the future. This is a little bit of what he says in the Grand Chessboard, talking about basically maintaining hegemonic power for the U.S. on a geostrategic level. Quote, Eurasian geostrategy involves the purposeful management of geostrategically dynamic states and the careful handling of geopolitically catalytic states in keeping with the twin interests of of America in the short-term preservation of its unique global power and in the long-run transformation of it into increasingly institutionalized cooperation. To put it in a terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires, the three grand imperatives of imperial geostrategy are to prevent the collusion and maintain security dependence amongst the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant and protected, and to keep the barbarians from coming together. Unquote. Now, Franklin Roosevelt, U.S. president from 1933 to 1945, I mentioned before, in the privatization of energy, and I went into how he met with the Saudi king back in the day when the U.S. was seeing that its global peak was on the horizon, and cut a deal back in the day with the Saudi president, which set, helped set a course for the future. This is what Franklin Roosevelt said. I hereby find that the defense of Saudi Arabia is vital to the defense of America, of the United States. Now, so here, what Brzezinski's saying is protecting our, you know, vassals and all of that, you know, and all of that. You can see the whole continuation of belief systems that have historically taken place amongst those who are a part of maintaining the ruling economic order for the U.S. empire. Now, the reason why I mention that is that most people know and talk about the, you know, PNAC project of the New American Century. Now, I'm going to read a little bit from their actual document and show you a certain aspect. And here's what they say. Quote, our first objective is to prevent the reemergence of a new rival, either on the territory of the former Soviet Union or elsewhere, that poses a threat on the order or that poses formally by the Soviet Union. There are three additional aspects to this objective. First, the U.S. must show the leadership necessary to establish and protect a new order that holds the promise of convincing potential competitors that they need not aspire to a greater role or pursue a more aggressive posture to protect their legitimate interests. Second, in the non-defense areas, we must account sufficiently for the interests of the advanced industrial nations to discourage them from challenging our leadership or seeking to overrun the established political and economic order. Finally, we must maintain the mechanisms for deterring potential competitors from even aspiring to a larger regional or global role, unquote. In other words, if you look at the Grand Chessboard by Brzezinski, where he's talking about the geo strategy and America, quote, in the short term preservation of its unique global power and in the long run transformation of its increasing institutionalized cooperation, to, and talked about maintaining this whole situation, that the three grand imperatives of imperial geo strategy are to prevent collusions and maintain security dependence amongst the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant and protected, i.e. like Saudi Arabia, and to keep the barbarians from coming together. This is no different than what the neocons are saying. The situation is that since these particular types of writings and stuff and Roosevelt's statement, you have had a situation where the euro has come into formation and has posed just that type of threat to the U.S. hegemonic imperial dollarism dominance. In other words, what I'm saying in part is that one of the true axis of evils that Boy George did not mention is the euro. That's the real world. See, they can throw all this smoke and mirrors games around, you know, and talk about, you know, culture wars and, you know, war on Muslims and a war on this and all that. That's all smoke and mirrors games. This is about maintaining the order. As they know, energy, oil, is the key resource to maintaining hegemonic power. Now, let's deal in how in 1999, with the launch of the euro, how this played a whole nother dynamic into this situation, and why developments in other parts of the world concerning the euro and other things are now developing, like in places like Iran. So check this out.
What happened on January 1st of 1999 is the euro was launched, and that's the first time since the Roman Empire that the European countries were united under a single currency. So, I mean, it's been, you know, almost 2,000 years since this has last happened. So that's a big event. The Europeans created the euro to tie their economic fates together so they would not go to war against each other like they did for 300 years prior to the, you know, after, up to the Second World War. And the euro is designed to be an alternative world to the way of currency. So we're really entering into a system where we have a large economic block of around $11 trillion economy in the United States. We have the world reserve currency. And we have the European Union, which is around $10.5 trillion, almost the same size, but with a bigger population, and also want their currency to be the world reserve currency. So, and the determinant of that status is dependent upon what currency is used to purchase the most valuable and largest commodities market in the world, and that is oil and gas. And we've had the luxury of having the dollar as the standard transaction for oil since the beginning of the age of oil, you know, back in Texas 100 years ago. But just like in the 1970s, early 1970s, when the dollar became devalued after breaking the dollar-gold link, you know, OPEC was about to move towards selling oil and sell different currencies, including the dollar, but as well as the Canadian dollar, you know, the Japanese yen, the German mark, all these different currencies. And the United States intervened secretly and blocked that. And so we sort of got our way. And now we've got the euro out there, and the European Union is just quite clear that they want this currency to be able to buy and be able to price oil because it reduces their currency risk. And the United States is equally adamant that this never happened, and we're willing to fight over this, as evidenced in Iraq. And now Iran is about to do something even far worse than Iraq, and that's open up an oil board for international oil trade to dominate in the euro.
All right, now, what that gets into is that the Iranian government says that they plan to compete with basically New York and London in the whole international petroleum exchange. In New York, you have the New York Mercantile Exchange, and in London, you have the International Petroleum Exchange. These are part of the imperial structures, as we outlined before, going into the whole aspect of how the pivoting access that you see with Boy George and Blair rest upon the economic structure and how they cooperate in the centers of power, of economic power within the U.S. and the New York MEX and the London International Petroleum Exchange, the IPE. Now, the Iranian government says that they plan to set up their own trading system, and they plan on it being based in the euro. Now, one of the hindrances, I don't want to oversimplify it, but one of the hindrances of a more flowing euro-based oil transition system is the lack of a euro-dominated oil pricing standard, what's called an oil marker. Because they're all basically dominated by SAM, you know. So you have what's called the WTI, the West Texas Intermediate, and then once again, the UK's, the other part of the axis of the imperial machine, the Brent Cruise, and then there's one in Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, which kind of... See, you know, all this stuff about the port and all of that. See, all of these guys are working together. This is why I emphasize poor slaves not to get hoodwinked by all this rhetoric about so-called cultural wars or war on Muslims and all of that type of stuff. Because here you have Dubai, while they're yelling about the port, which is all just a fraud in the first place, because this is about elite power in cooperation with themselves. Here you have the oil standard, oil marker, being dominated by those within the Western power matrix. And that would be, of course, the West Texas Intermediate Crude, WTI, the UK's Brent Crude, and United Arab Emirates. So these cats are capitalists. They're not talking about, it's not about, you know, who you bend your little knees down to and all of that type of stuff. This is about domination. Now, when in June of 2004, when Iran announced its plans to create the Iranian oil burst, basically that whole, you know, the burst is a stock exchange security trading system. That, of course, would put it in a direct competition if it came online. If other factors were also to take place, and this has to do with certain capital factors in the European Union, but it would facilitate, regardless, this transaction taking place, and the competition would intensify with the Atlantic-based intercontinental exchange network, which basically owns IPI, who I mentioned before, and the New York exchange system, the whole New York mercantile exchange. So basically, it's an Atlantic-based intercontinental exchange ownership. So so basically, it's based in Sam's hands. But the reason why I mentioned this is that if the Iranians were to go online, this would be the fourth crude marker. Oil marker, and this one would be the first one based in the euro, which would be a dynamic shift, and it would also blow international commerce into the Middle East. Now, on a certain level, this would only make sense because 65% of the reported known crude oil in the planet is in the Middle East. So just from that aspect, one could see how those players would want more of a play within this whole market system. As you know, because we're not talking about a cooperative system, network, and world. We're talking about cats who are out for theirs. So now, one of the dynamics that is going on is that right now, you basically have a situation where the euro is now going from like 20 to 25% of a more appreciated value than the U.S. dollar. So if you were to buy, a barrel of oil in U.S. dollars from the New York Mercantile or the IPI, it would be about, you know, if you were to buy it for $50, you know, it would be like $37 if you were to buy it through the Iranian, you know, burst through it going through the euro, because the U.S. dollar is so much more depreciated. Basically, because of the vulnerability and the indebtedness that the U.S. keeps indulging the whole world with, that has created a situation where the whole economic structure of the planet that is based in this market system is unstable. It's much more unstable than they're letting on. So the U.S. has created a planetary economic unstableness, and now you have other people seeing that the euro is much more stable, and it is valuable on an economic level. You can get more bang out of the buck, is what I'm saying. So of course they would be more privy to go that route, especially as many people watch Saddam's value in assets appreciate incredibly. Now the U.S. is aware of that. The U.S. imperialists are aware of that. So, and being the U.S. imperialist, marketized imperialists that they are, this is not about what's in the best interest of humanity. This is about maintaining their control. And they know that dollarism is a key component of this. And they talk about it amongst themselves. You know, they leave it amongst knuckleheads basically to think that if they vote in, you know, this Democrat versus that Republican, or if they just go after this particular lobbyist group, you know, AIPAC or whatever, that this would, you know, or if they just deal with the neocons, you know, all this whatever. Well, let me just make it cold out of the mouths of someone who is a noted imperialist structural organizers for the machine, Henry Kissinger, on the whole dollar stuff. This is what Kissinger said, quote, "Who controls the food supply controls the people. Who controls the energy can control whole continents. Who controls money can control the world," unquote. So, no fluff, no smoke and mirrors. They know what's going on and how essential it is to maintain the U.S. dollar hegemony at the expense of the world. But that's not, hey, that's not an issue to them. Now, the EU25, which keeps expanding, its GDP is 10.5 trillion. The U.S. is around 11 trillion, so it's about equal. But the U.S., the EU is expanding, like I said. The U.S. is not expanding, and the EU has more people. The U.S. has what, 280 million people. The EU has 480 million people. So it's clear to the world economy how and what direction the things are headed. So the U.S. is committed at this point that it can't compete as things are playing itself out on this type of economic flow of things, as other countries are making decisions. China and other countries are hinting at starting to diversify their portfolio and buy and go, you know, EUs and Euro and stuff like that. So the other pillar of U.S. dominance is now being pulled out. The gunboats. Now, once again, let's have Clark outline how the strength of the U.S. dollar is based in the price of oil to give you even more of a crystallization of what I'm trying to outline, how the whole petrodollar dynamic is playing itself out. Check this out.
It's interesting. I was reading in the Asia Times just a couple of weeks ago that in 2002, there was slightly less than $4 trillion held overseas. By the middle of 2005, or 3.5 years later, that went from around $4 trillion to $6.6 trillion. Now, as you mentioned, the price of oil more than doubled, about 2.5 times more expensive. And about 60% of this $6.6 trillion out there is parked in U.S. treasuries. And the foreign banks are increasing their supply of dollars to compensate for the increase in the supply of oil. And this person who made this analysis basically said about 60% of this money is contributed to or is laid to what I would call petrodollars. So basically about $1.5 trillion have been soaked up by the international community since 2002 to purchase oil because of the price of oil has increased, like you said, almost 2.5-fold during the same interval. So the same thing happened in the 1974-1973 oil shocks. The price of oil went up by 400%, and the demand and liquidity value of the dollar went up by 400%, and the debt of the third world nations went up by 400%, and the amount of exchanges held by, let's say, Germany, of dollar exchange went up by 400%. So there's a correlation between oil prices and demand for dollars. So, yes, I think what we've seen here is more central banks have to hold dollars because they are the petrodollar and they're needed to transact next month's energy or oil bill. And that's really what's sort of driving these big macroeconomic demands for the dollar. It's not, you know, that the Federal Reserve increased the interest rate by a quarter of a percentage point or a half percentage point, even 1.5 percentage points, resulting in people, you know, soaking up another $2.6 trillion when really about 60% of that is probably to buy oil.
Okay, so once again, the slave's reality is not to be caught up in illusion. and this is why I'm emphasizing some of these aspects, is that, the American experience, and, you know, when you hear people talk about where do you see another standard of living, you know, better than America and all of that type of stuff, where is better than this and all of that rhetoric. See, this dynamic that took place with Nixon and company and how that was manipulated helps outline how the standard of the U.S., the economic standard that the masses of people in this country as a byproduct are able to obtain as opposed to the rest of the world, has nothing to do with the Constitution or Christian American values or the fact that you can mark biracial on your little identity card as opposed to saying you're black or Chinese or whatever. And none of this stuff. Yeah, you know, it has to do with the whole economic dollarism formation through imperial wars, dynamics, and constructs as they have played themselves out. So you have countries are soaking up American debts and bonds and goods so that they can get U.S. dollars to buy oil. So it's just a circling a dynamic, but they have to pulverize their population to do so. Meanwhile, the U.S. is able to discipline its population by basically being an importer society, because the oil is the core marker of the dollar and how the dollar is set. So you have this dynamic that, you know, in the Observer, it stated how, quote, Iraq nets handsome profits by dumping dollar for euro. And they talk about how the euro had gained 25% against the U.S. dollar after Iraq switched. They talk about the financial advantage that Iraq had had as the euro appreciated, and how the U.S. The U.S. dollar, which really devalued a whole lot between 2001 and 2003, the euro's appreciation had swelled the Iraqi funds to the $10 billion that I had mentioned before. When Iraq started this the trade in euro and this oil for food exchange, from $10 billion to $26 billion. So here you had that incredible increase, and the U.S. itself, who was buying 2/3 of Iraqi's oil, was forced to buy. Its companies, its corporations, were forced to buy the Iraqi oil under this oil for food chain exchange in euros. Now you can imagine, just imagine how infuriated the ruling elite, the corporatists, were, who were in this situation. So during the 2001 to 2003 oil for food exchange that was going on, Iraq was basically pumping out about 2.5, no, what was it? They were pumping out about 3.3 million barrels of oil a day. And Sam, buying 2/3, was pumping out, or buying about 2.5 billion. So, and they had to buy it in euros. So Saddam has that game going on. He's benefiting economically from it. And the U.S. knows that he has all these contracts set up with everyone but him, just about. And of course, and excluding the U.K., except for a little small firm, not the British Petroleum. Now, the whole world is watching this, except for people in America primarily, who are, you know, watching, you know, the next reality show or whatever. But people can see what's going on, and they can see how Saddam is benefiting economically his society going euro as opposed to this greenback that's pulverizing him. So of course that's going to be more and more enticing, because the more debt that the U.S. empire intentionally perpetuates, the more debt that the rest of the world has to eat. And that was a diet that more and more people are finding themselves not being able to consume. Now, within this thing that Saddam kind of sparked, every month, it seems like, another country announces that they're at least diversifying or thinking about their currency beyond the U.S. dollar. Let's explore that.
Really, a week that doesn't go by, or a month in which some bankers tell something and about diversifying their currency exchange, most recently with China this month. And so we're moving into a world where we're going to have two reserve currencies, and because of the massive debt of the United States, you know, the powers that be are trying to prevent this from happening. But in my opinion, going back to this event in 1999, really the launch of the euro sort of created a de facto bipolar world from an economic perspective, because economies, the aggregate economies of the European Union and the United States are about the same in size. And you've got more trade to go to these oil producing nations than the United States. Over half the trade, about 50% or more, goes, is imported milk, at least from the European Union. It's only a small fraction of the United States. So we really have a bipolar world economically that most Americans, I don't think it's really sunk in yet, the significance of the euro, nor the sunk in significance of the petro-euro versus the petrodollar conflict.
All right, so you see a dynamic where China and other countries diversifying. Now, they know that of the two pillars that they had to deal with in the real world against the U.S. empire, military and the greenback, it's not really a good idea to go up against this mad dog on a military level. But its Achilles heel is the greenback. So they're diversifying. And more of them are talking more and more about it. As Dr. Morjara, he, in a talk, was commented by in the Hindu Business Line in June of 2003, and this is what the Hindu Business Line said. Dr. Morjara implied the switch to the euro, which as done during the last few months, had helped Iran to negate the effects of a depreciating dollar and falling international oil prices. He said that if the country had continued its receipts in dollars, it would have meant large losses, which would have translated into domestic inflation. This was because large volumes of its imports are sourced from Europe. The Iranian central bank has been keen to avert that situation and has consequently adopted the euro-dominated payments to ensure that the losses are minimized. The country has also resorted to managing its reserves to minimize the effects of the depreciating dollar. Now, so here you have a situation where the dollar is so unstable that you have a dynamic on a global scale where other countries are not even able to continue to absorb these types of hits, even though the U.S. empire is just saying, eat it, eat it, eat it. So with the euro option, they're saying, no, thank you. And they're diversifying, and in some cases, it's not out of to try to discipline the U.S. So much, even though you have that type of thing happening, like when the U.S. unilaterally just stomped into Iraq in this current war, countries like China began to dump dollars and stuff. So they're perpetuating, the U.S. is perpetuating this schism. But you also have societies with another option, just out of just trying to maintain certain types of stability, diversifying. And once again, this is something that people within the financial empire structures within the U.S. knows quite well, even though they smoke and mirrors it, you know, in you know, on Fox News and all this weapons of mass destruction stuff, which, as I'm more or less trying to outline, that the weapon of mass destruction towards the U.S. in the U.S. empire's mind, their real mind, is the euro. But Steve Johnson and Javier Blas in the Financial Times in December of 2004, they had this to say: oil exporters have sharply reduced their exposure to the dollar over the past 3 years, according to data from the Bank for International Settlements. Members of OPEC have cut their proportions of deposits held in dollars from 75% in the third quarter of 2001 to 61.5% by the third quarter of 2004. Middle Eastern central banks have reportedly switched reserves from dollars to euros and sterling to avoid incurring losses, as the dollar has fallen and prepared for a shift away from pricing oil exports in dollars alone. So once again, here you have a situation where the whole global community is seeing, and now since 2004, it has fallen to 60%. So it's not even at 61.5% now. It continues to collapse. But because in essence, what I'm saying is that this is part of a dying empire. And and since it's so deindustrialized, its base, and since it's so transfixed into an incredible predatory type of situation, it is not about to facilitate any kind of, you know, dual euro system and all of that. It's just saying, pull out the gun, pull out the gunboats, and pull out the F-16s. The Economist, 2004, also wrote, "The disappearing dollar. The dollar has been the leading international currency for as long as most people can remember, but its dominant role can no longer be taken for granted. If America keeps on spending and borrowing at the present pace, the dollar will eventually lose its mighty status in international finance, and that would hurt the privilege of being able to print the world reserve currency, a privilege which now is at risk. Allows America to borrow cheaply and thus spend more than it earns on far better terms than are available to others," unquote. So once again, you can see the dynamic that is playing out as other societies are developing options and are seeing how the U.S. is dedicated in disciplining the world population into staying into its petrodollar mechanism that is basically a hegemonic imperial a system for U.S. global domination. Now, the OPEC nations themselves in 2001 had 75% of their reserves in U.S. dollars. Today, it's 60%. The euro was only launched in 1999, January. Now, but we've seen since that time, with the world economic situations within the U.S. empire, an incredible currency momentum shift.
There's all this talk that's been going on since really 2002, when the euro reached parity value with the dollar, that, you know, you'll have this announcement every so often by OPEC members saying, you know, we're thinking about throwing oil in the basket of currencies, including the dollar and the euro. And every time they come out with a little statement like that, the dollar goes down on the foreign exchange markets, the euro goes up. And the fact that, as you've noticed, the Bank for International Settlements has said that the money from OPEC, petrodollars, isn't flowing back to the United States like it once was, or at least like it has historically. And the fact that these countries are increasing, you know, Saudi Arabia or Iran, obviously, Iraq. These countries were increasing their reserves in the euro, so it's quite clear that by the end of this decade, oil will be sold in the euro and in the dollar, possibly another currency as well. And I think the message is quite clear, but what that really means is the United States won't have the unlimited credit card, or the Federal Reserve won't have the unlimited credit card to create credit effortlessly by demand for petrodollars.
So you can see the whole dynamic that's taking place rapidly. And the euro is 20% the value of the dollar. The U.S. has incredible debt that are increasingly being impossible for the world economy to continue to consume. It's unstabilizing the planet. The U.S. is in decline. And it's using its second pillar to try to prop up the other pillar of its hegemonic power, dollarism, which is basically a form of globalization or globalism, to maintain itself. These are the dangerous times that we find ourselves in. And one of the aspects that slaves who don't have a passport get a passport and start thinking of also other places like within South America as places of building relationships and connections, because as the U.S. Becomes spiraling out of control, its possibility of going nuclear raises up more and more as its desperation to maintain its hegemonic power explodes more and more. And working with slaves who see the dollar imperialist structure as a cornerstone of one of the problems with the whole global market situation is one of the things that we need to do, and not allow ourselves to be caught up in the illusion in. Hold on a sec. Like I said, we can allow ourselves to be caught up in the illusion, because the illusion and these types of illusions are just what these bandits want us caught up in.
If you're a conservative Republican, watching the news these days can make you feel as though you are in the Twilight Zone. Americans are under attack from Islamic extremists in every corner of the world. Homosexuals are mocking holy matrimony, and the lesbians and feminists are attacking everything sacred. Liberal judges have completely rewritten the Constitution. You can burn the American flag and kill a million babies a year, but you can't post the Ten Commandments or say God in public. Seven out of every 10 black children are born out of wedlock, and Jackson and Sharpton claim the answer is racial quotas. And the aliens are here, but they didn't come in a spaceship. They came across our unguarded Mexican border by the millions.
I'm Vernon Robinson. If you send me to Congress, I'll send that back to the Twilight Zone. I approve of this message and of traditional American values.
Like I said, this is all a surreal illusion that they're trying to play. Because the traditional American values that the administrators for the empire and the order itself are for global domination, that is based in militarism and dollarism. Dollar imperialism on a military scale is what us slaves have to resist against if we're going to inherit an earth worth living in. Until the next time, slave out.